Hello and welcome to Psychic Teachers. I'm your host, Samantha Fay.
I'm Deb Bowen.
And we've been discussing our January book club of the month on Becoming an Alchemist by Catherine McCowan. In part one, we went over all of her tips for really learning how to become a true manifester and alchemize your soul so that you can achieve the goals and dreams you want to manifest in your life. In this section, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of what she talks about. Now, last week, we were talking about how important it is to focus on the hows and whys of your goals, to really look at your attention and your thoughts as currency that you're paying towards manifesting these goals. One thing that she talks about in part two, and I really loved this phrase, she says that the great work we're all being called to do now is to reincarnate into our life now. I loved that play on words. Instead of thinking about, you know, reincarnating into another lifetime after this one has ended, she says, think about reincarnating yourself now into your life with this knowledge within you. And so one of the exercises she gives, she says, write a list of I am statements and then cross out the ones that are impermanent. So for example, I could say, I am blonde, I have blue eyes, I am a teacher, I am a seeker, right? Then she says, cross out those statements that are impermanent. Okay, well, I am blonde. Well, yeah, I was born blonde, then it went kind of brown, and now I get it highlighted. So that's impermanent. Yes, I do have blue eyes, that's never changed. I am a teacher, I am a seeker. Okay, so I've crossed out one statement. Then she says, go back and cross out any statements that will no longer be true after you die. Well, obviously, I still won't be blonde. I won't have blue eyes. I won't have a body. I might not be a teacher, but I will always be a seeker. I liked that exercise of writing down all of your I am statements. And if I did this, well, I did do the whole full thing, but it's too long and too personal to share. Try doing this where you write down all your I am statements and crossing out anything that is impermanent and then crossing out anything that will no longer exist after you die. What is left is who you really are. And getting to the core of who you really are is step one in reincarnating into your life now.
Love that idea of reincarnating into our life now in this lifetime.
Yeah, I do too. It's very hopeful, isn't it?
It is.
So she talks a lot about how some of the things, or really the main thing, that holds us back from reincarnating into our life is fear. And she says that pain plus fear equals suffering. I found that really interesting. She says pain really isn't that bad to endure until we add fear to it. I do think that's true. She writes, follow the advice of the Buddha if you want to mitigate the suffering. He taught that on its own, pain is just an intense sensation. It turns to suffering when you add fear. Think of what it's like to cut your finger by accident while chopping food. That's pain. Then imagine that someone is going to cut your finger on purpose. They warn you that they're going to do it, and you have to hold still while you watch the knife slowly descend. That's suffering. You can't eliminate pain, but you can alleviate the suffering by subtracting the fear, which comes not from loss itself, but from our anticipation of the loss. That's not new stuff, but it still is very profound, isn't it?
I'm going to have to process that a while.
Okay, well, she gives like a very bland example. She says, let's say, for example, that baldness runs in your family and you'd rather not be bald. Each time you comb your hair, you find a few strands between the teeth of the comb. The loss of a dozen hairs or so isn't noticeable on your head. You only mind them on the comb because they're a reminder of what's coming. If one day you were to decide that a full head of hair really didn't matter to you, finding lost hairs on the comb wouldn't bother you. It wouldn't be painful. That's the basic logic of non-attachment. Stop clinging to what you're likely to lose, and the losing won't hurt as much. No thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts on that. You know, I'm getting old. And as you get old, you lose your hair and you lose mobility and you lose a lot of stuff. And it isn't Yes, it's indeed partly the fear and the of anticipating what may be coming or what is probably coming, but it's also living in the moment sometimes of fear and living in the moment of pain and suffering. So I'm not sure I completely agree with her. I understand where she was going with that, but I think I may have some caveats to what she said.
Well, I do think that a lot of suffering comes from anticipating the fear. I really, really do. And I think when we can just accept what's coming, we can alleviate some of the suffering. You know, take, for example, watching my father slowly die. I mean, losing him in inches was so, so painful. But looking back, what was the most painful was not knowing how or when this would happen or how quickly we would lose him or how long he would be in pain, all those unknowns. And once I was able to just accept that really I had already lost my father to Alzheimer's and just enjoy whatever I had left of him, a lot of that suffering did alleviate. I can remember going to visit him. And instead of trying to talk to him, which, you know, he really wasn't able to do for the last year of his life, I would just sit on the couch with him and I would just put my head on his shoulder and we would watch a show. And then I would push him. He loved these long walks outside in his wheelchair. And then we'd go to the chapel and say our prayers. And I just got into the routine of doing that and enjoying that rather than, you know, I used to think, oh, I wish I could talk to my dad about this that's going on, or, oh, he would love this news story. He would really dive his teeth into that. And I just had to let that all go. And I do think that sometimes when we're going through loss, really, you just have to accept it. I think so much of the pain comes in the resistance and the fear.
As you're describing, I think that's true. I do.
She says it's important to refrain from trying to understand the reason for your misfortune. She says, look neither to the past for how it happened, nor to the future for why. Don't blame others. Don't blame yourself. Don't draw any lesson. Just experience the pain while allowing it to go entirely unexplained. So then she goes into the different steps for learning how to do this. And she says, step one is calcination. She says that what we're doing here when we're learning to sit with the pain as we're learning to calcinate it so that it no longer equates suffering. Then she discusses disillusion, which occurs in the gap between desire and attainment. And I think that gap is where, you know, oftentimes we lose the momentum for what we're trying to manifest. She says you have to figure out what you authentically desire to attain by going through the next stage, which is separation. And it's here that you determine what you want and what you don't want. It's here that you focus on the outcome you want. That's really, really crucial to think about. What do you want? What don't you want? And you know, so much of manifesting teaches us to never focus on what we don't want. I'll always tell my students in classes, don't put in your goal book, for example, I don't want to be in debt anymore, because you don't want to affirm debt. You would instead put in your goal book, I am so happy that I pay my bills with ease and have money left over for savings and fun. And she's saying, before you even get to that process of focusing on your goals, you have to go through this step of really writing down and thinking about what you clearly do not want. This helps you set firm boundaries, and it helps the universe figure out what it is that they're co-creating with you.
Samantha, so much of what she is proposing here in this book is almost perfectly counter to everything in the manifesting world that we've been taught. And I find that interesting. And that exact example of don't say don't. Don't use words that are trigger words for negative manifesting, like the word debt. I mean, how many times and how many workshops have you and I used that example? I can't begin to count. So I'm wondering what a mind shift, a thought process shift, working from her model will be for so many people who have for so long been entrenched in another way of attempting to manifest. I don't know the answer to that. I'm just throwing that out there as something to ponder.
I don't know if I know the answer either, but I actually think what she is saying can work in tandem with what other manifesting teachers and books have said. I think many manifesting books and teachings jump to the end. This book is talking about all the internal stuff that has to happen within you before you're ready to manifest these outward goals. So I think this is almost like a prerequisite to manifesting courses, if that makes sense.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So to write down everything that you don't want, you wouldn't put that on your vision board or your goal book. You wouldn't use that in your affirmation statements. This would just be the beginning stuff you would do to really focus on who am I? Why am I here? What do I want to create now? And that'll help you to put limits on the goals that you're choosing to focus on. But it'll also help you, I think, to set really firm boundaries. Now, from here, we move to conjunction, which is where we learn to look at conflicts or challenges in our life without trying to solve them. All right, that's another hard one. How do you look at a conflict in your life without trying to solve it?
Because that's your my natural instinct is to say, oops, this is a problem. There are many sides to it. What can I do to fix it? We're fixers.
Yeah, I think that's our first impulse is to either run from it or fix it or talk about it a lot or whine and complain about it. But to just sit there and observe it, I think it's a great suggestion because it allows us to be present. You know, so many of us are focused on distracting ourselves from any points of pain or maybe some sad inner reflection. Or when we have conflict, I think a lot of us will learn to, like you said, fix that conflict, or we'll go to others for advice and help. And that's one thing she talks a lot about not to do.
Let me ask this question. Is what she's talking about here in some way detachment?
I think so, but not really. Because remember, she's saying you've got to be the driver of your life. You've got to consciously reincarnate into your life. I think what she's saying is we need to stop applying judgment to everything that happens in our life. We need to stop applying blame, whether it's to ourselves or others, to everything that happens to our life. And just pause a moment before we get there to think and sit with the emotions and feelings of that conflict and let it be. So I don't think she's saying detachment all the time, forever. I think she's saying in the moment of the conflict, in the moment where it's going on, and you might get in that, remember how last week we talked about that occult prison, that circular thinking where you see no way out, you're in that rock and hard place. I think she's saying rather than try to fight your way out or just be a passive passenger and sit in that occult prison, I think what she's saying is just pause a moment and observe it. It's really the only way to find the door. Now, the next step on the alchemist journey is fermentation. And she says, this is where we learn to maintain inner silence. And this is often when we experience the dark night of the soul. She says, you're letting go of parts of you, your life, and memories that no longer serve you. I found that really interesting because I think a lot of us have gone through a dark night of the soul. I know a lot of our listeners have. And when you're in it, you can feel like it's just never going to end. She says, to maintain inner silence about the cause of your dark night is especially difficult. You keep wanting to figure out what's wrong with you. The two explanations that everyone comes up with, i.e. spiritual beings are either non-existent or rejecting you, are dead wrong. But wiser souls than you and I have nevertheless succumbed to them in the darkest moments. Instead of doubting or repudiating your past spiritual experiences, you just try to forget about them for now. When you are below, meaning on that vertical plane we talked about last week, it is impossible to get any perspective on above. So one thing she says, and this happens, I think, on everyone's manifesting journey. You start off, or your spiritual awakening path, this also happens there too. You start off, you're all excited, you're getting all these connections with your guides, your angels, you're manifesting things left and right, you're meeting your spiritual tribe, you feel connected to all that is. And then something happens, conflict occurs, a block arises, a boundary is broken, a challenge is just right there in the middle of your path, and suddenly it all goes away. The feeling of being connected, the feeling of having those divine insights and inspirations. You feel as though your guides and angels aren't listening. This is when the universe is challenging you, really, to ask yourself, is this really who you are? Is this really what you want? Our job isn't necessarily to push through it. Our job is to sit with it. And I think that's a really hard thing. She has a whole section on, you know, are you really fermenting your soul when you're going through this dark night of the soul, or is it depression? And she says, while in the form of fermentation, the dark night of the soul, you might say, I'm depressed. But most of the symptoms of clinical depression are absent. You're not anxious, hopeless, self-hating, or fixated on the past. Physically, you feel pretty much like your normal self. No marked changes in eating habits or sleep. No more substance abuse than is typical of you. Socially, you might be somewhat withdrawn and feel a little lonely, but you don't feel as if others have rejected or abandoned you. You might feel profoundly indifferent to your usual activities, but you're as capable as ever of going through the motions and meeting your responsibilities. You just feel blah. So that's the difference between depression and this fermentation process. And I think it's really important to differentiate between those two. She's clearly saying a dark night of the soul is not being depressed. It's just feeling kind of blah and kind of wondering, you know, what's happening? Where did everyone go? Where is my connection?
When I've had those moments in my life, or those times, because sometimes they last longer than moments, when I've had that, I know that there's usually some kind of a sign for me that says, Deb, this is fallow time. This is time for you to just be with what's bubbling around you right now and trust that something will be different. And that was a hard lesson to learn early on. I don't think I got that so clearly. But as I've gotten older, I've begun to realize that I need that dark time, that it is out of the darkness that the light does in fact come.
It does, yes. And she points out that in St. John of the Cross's book on A Dark Night of the Soul, he says that whatever we experience in the spiritual, whether it's bliss, meaning positive, or it's this fermentation, blah, sadness, in the moment we feel that it's eternal, that it will last forever. And then she writes, I know of two other useful distinctions between depression and fermentation. The onset of depression tends to be gradual, moving from bad to worse, while the onset of a dark night of the spirit is abrupt. Yesterday you felt normal, and today, for no accountable reason, you're in the pit of despair. Remission is equally sudden. You wake up one day feeling just fine and can't explain the change. So she says, during this period of fermentation, you might experience many of these sharp fluctuations between normal and sad. And she says, there's kind of an all or nothing quality to this period. When you go down, you plummet rapidly. When you return and go up again, your vibrations are raising. You feel okay and much, much better. It's not like a one and done. You know what I mean? Like during this fermentation process is going to have this roller coaster up and down for a while until you just sit with it.
What I would invite people to do if they think this is what they're experiencing in this process that Catherine has written about is that you journal it, that you write it, and you remember to write. And I'm good at writing the head and down stuff and the diving in and getting darker part. But I'm not always good at remembering to write as I rise and come back up and have learned lessons. So I invite people to really process that in some way, whether you write it, whether you record it on a tape recorder, whatever, that you have a record of that learning process, that fermentation process.
Yeah, I think that's really important too. And she also talks about be mindful during these periods of who you're hanging out with, because if you're around people who are similarly feeling sad and down, or if they're just kind of a woe is me person in general, that's not going to help your fermentation process. Be careful about what kind of thoughts and activities you're allowing into your mind during this time, and be careful who you're hanging out with. So it might be, if you're going through a fermentation time, it is a good time, as Deb said, to write or talk to a therapist, but it's also a good time to reach out to positive friends who are feeling happy and uplifted, and to watch and read positive and uplifting material to just kind of keep yourself buoyant during those times, but also to keep in mind that this too shall pass. Just as the blissful moments don't last forever, neither do these, you know, really, really bad ones last forever either. And I think that's really, really important. Finally, she says, once you've risen from the depths of despair, there are only two more steps to go. Sublimation is where thoughts become action. So that's the second to last step. And she says, you don't need to think about what you will or won't do. You just do. You're moving through the world from a place of intuitive knowing. You are a part of the flow. And I'm sure many of us have experienced that as well. It's a wonderful feeling when you're just kind of everything, doors are opening where before there were just walls. You know, you're meeting the right people at the right time, and you feel as though you're connected to all that is, and you feel very at peace with all of it. It's a beautiful stage of this process to go through.
I think that's the natural evolution of the process if we allow it to happen. When we come out of this place and go into this transition period here at the end, that's the real beauty of the whole idea, ultimately, I think.
Yes, I do too. And she says when we're in this sublimation area of our journey, we learn the power of thought. And she says when we project thought, we are overwhelming the energy of whatever it is we wish to influence or change with the power of our own more concentrated energy. Thus, we can prevail over any weaker energy and might also prevail over energies that are stronger but less focused. And she says the magic of projected thought is rather mechanical in this sense. And, you know, I think that's something we all need to think about. There's something that was trending, I think, over the holidays on TikTok called the Marilyn Monroe effect. And there's this famous story where Marilyn Monroe was walking down the street with one of her friends in New York City. And they're just walking down the street. And Marilyn Monroe looked like Marilyn Monroe, right? This isn't when she was, what was her former name? This isn't in her Norma Jean days. This is when she was Marilyn Monroe, the bleach blonde hair and all the charisma she had. And they're walking down the street. And her friend says to her, I'm so surprised, like no one's noticed you. You haven't been stopped for an autograph. Like normally when we go out together, you're mobbed. And she said, well, I haven't turned on Marilyn Monroe. And he says, what do you mean? And she says, you want me to do it now? And he says, yeah, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. And he said, you know, she didn't do anything. She didn't say anything. But suddenly she just projected this aura. He said, literally, cars started honking. Suddenly, she was mobbed by fans asking for her autograph. A paparazzi came up and took their photo. And he said, you know, he's still mystified by that. But I think that's the power of thought. When she started the day with her friend walking down the street, she didn't want to be Marilyn Monroe. She wanted to enjoy a day and go get lunch or coffee with her friend. And that was that. But when he said, this is kind of weird. No one's noticing you. She wanted to show him what the Marilyn Monroe effect was. What do you think about that?
I've read that story several times in several places. And I think it's very true. We all do that. And some of us do it more consciously than others. I don't mean I do, but I mean people in general. Do this, have this conscious ability to be who they want people to see them as. And I think that's certainly true in how we project what we want to manifest into our lives as well. We have an ability to put what's called a glamour over us or over a situation. And that's what Marilyn Monroe did.
Yeah. And I think, you know, not in that respect necessarily, but I think we can all do that in our own lives through the power of our thoughts. And so when you are manifesting, you want to have a little bit of that Marilyn Monroe effect, meaning you want to put out the best positive energy of yourself that you can, whatever that looks like to you. So whether you're trying to get a job, you want to put out an energy in the thought of confidence. If you're trying to manifest love, you want to put out an energy and thought of the give and take of love. Thoughts are real, and it's a real thing. So then the last stage she talks about is radiation, which is where we experience pure manifesting and sacred magic through surrender. How many of us love that word?
Wait. You just told me I have to control everything. I have to do stuff. I have all this stuff. And now I have to surrender. Is that what you just said?
That's what I just said. And you know that in manifesting, you've got to do all the inner work. You've got to keep your vibrations up and positive and high. You've got to try to keep your thoughts as positive as can be and project your thoughts for your goals out into the world. And then you have to surrender it. It's the old example of mailing a letter. You know, you've got to write down everything you want from the universe, but at some point, you've got to drop that letter in the mailbox and let it go. I think this is where a lot of people get stopped on their manifesting journey.
Oh, I think so too, because, you know, okay, so we've been working through this process. If I just were brand new to this and her model was what I was working through, and I've learned to do things and be in control and worry about the how and the why and spend time in contemplation and all this stuff. And then you're telling me, okay, after I've done all of that, then something bigger than me is going to take care of it.
Yep. And that's where surrender and trust come into play. I mean, think about it. I have a friend right now who's a teacher. And, you know, I think we all recognize that teachers are going through a lot right now. They're very stressed out and overworked. And the pandemic was incredibly hard on them. And so she is looking for a job that's very different and allows her to stay home. And so she decided to manifest that this year. And she got a job interview for the ideal job that would fit all of the qualifications she put into her goal book. And she was so excited. And then she learned in the first round of interviews that the job starts in March. And she's like, well, I can't quit. You know, I can't quit on my class in March. I can't do that. I'll burn that bridge. I can't. And everything was, I can't. And so I told her, I said, you've got to just surrender this. You know, you've got to just let this be what it is. Just if you want this, surrender it. If it's not this job, another one will come around. And so she thought about that and thought about that and was really trying to work on this idea of surrendering. And then her assistant comes in to work the next week and says, I got my teacher certification. I can't wait to apply for jobs next year. I hope there's an opening. She didn't see that coming, you know? So now she can take that job and leave in March knowing that the teacher assistant can step forward and finish out the semester if need be. So that's what I mean by surrender. You might not be able to see it in the moment, but you've got to just let that go. And I think that's what those manifesting teachers are talking about when they say the hows are the domain of the universe, you know? I think it's both. I think we have to be able to see and know our how. Right? Our why, you know, why do we want this goal? How can we take steps to achieve this goal? But knowing, just as I always say, that destiny and free will are in this beautiful dance all the time. And it's this magical balance we have to surrender to. It's the same with manifesting. Some of the hows are within our control. I mean, she had to brush up her resume. She had to find the job opening. She had to apply for it. She had to go for that interview. All of those hows were within her control. But the other part of the how, the destiny part, was not. And she had to surrender to that. You know, how will I leave this job and not burn all these bridges? How will I leave this job in the middle of the semester and not leave my students in a lurch? She had to surrender that. And I think that's what is so tricky with manifesting, because you've got to figure out, what do I have control over? What is my part to play in this manifesting dance? What don't I have control over? And until you do all that inner work, which Catherine in this book calls the great work, I don't think we can get to that beautiful flow that she talks about, where manifesting feels like magic.
And so that brings me to that whole question of, what does the universal energy, what does our life plan that we came into a given lifetime with already know about this process, even before we start thinking that we need to manifest something? Is the outcome already in some ways predestined?
I don't know that the outcome is predestined. I think there are many options, and that might explain parallel lives. I always look at life as like a marathon race, you know, and you can train for it and you can prepare for it. You can pick your teammates for that marathon or triathlon. you can look at the track that you're going to run, the path you're going to take. You can even do a pre-run to see how you do with it. But when it comes to the day of the race, so many other factors you can't control come into play. Maybe it rains. You know, maybe your sneakers are shot that day and you didn't even recognize it. Maybe there's a runner there who's so much better than you and it intimidates you and slows you down. You know, you just don't know. There's so many things that come into play. And I think that's how it is with life. I think on the other side, we put our blueprint for our soul plan down. We pick out our teammates, you know, who's going to help us and challenge us on this path. We look at where we want to go. We can see our whole path. But once we get here with all these other people and their soul plans and their paths and their free will, a lot of funky stuff can go on. And that's why I think it's this dance, this give and take.
That's a nice analogy. I'll go with that.
She says that, you know, to get to this last stage of radiation, it means you've learned to act on the authority of your own spirit without relying on any source or confirmation or justification. Now, that is something I still struggle with. If I have a really, really big decision that I have to make, it really helps me to talk it out with people. I like to get different people's opinions and points of view. And just in the last few years, I don't like that anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't actually, I always wonder now, I wonder if I let their strong opinions sway my decision, or I wonder if, you know, their judgment of my decision might be holding me back or putting up an invisible block I can't see. And so one of the things I have been working on in the last 5 years or so is not reaching out to others for their opinions or their viewpoint or their judgment or their validation. And I think that's a very hard thing for most of us to do. Reese Witherspoon was famously quoted last year for saying something along the lines of, "I only really achieved happiness when I stopped caring what other people think of me." And that's, you know, that's so true.
I think that is such a valid statement. And I don't know that I'll ever get there. I am concerned about how people see me. I want people to see me as I hope I am, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think to some point we all care what people think of us, but at the end of the day, you know, it doesn't really matter. This is what I always say to myself. Are they going to be at your funeral, Samantha? Because like, if they're not going to be with me for the long haul, if they're not going to, you know, really be with me through all the steps, then it doesn't matter what they think.
I'm just envisioning the folks that I think will be at my funeral, and I hope they're having a good time, you know?
But haven't you ever thought that, you know, like, I don't know. I think about that a lot. I think about that a lot. Like I have a friend who's, you know, a little bit of a workaholic, and I'll always say to her, is your boss going to be at your bedside when you're in hospice, you know, 50 years from now? No, but your kids are, you know, your husband is. That's what matters. And so maybe I'll always care, you know, what my kids think of me or my best friends think of me. But for the most part, I am learning to let go of what, you know, just other random people think of me. And it goes in and out. And I think that's important. It's something that I took away from this book is all of this goes in and out. This is not a one and done. It's not like you do the great inner work and suddenly you are, I don't know, an ascended being, right? It goes in and out. There are moments in my life where I manifest easily. I feel so tuned into the world around me that I am like, you know, walking on air. And then there are moments when all of that falls away and I feel that there's nothing but challenges and blocks around me. And then it flips again. It's the Wheel of Fortune card, the Wheel of Life card from Tarot.
Cycle round and round and round and round again.
We do.
And some lessons feel bigger than others, and some processes feel bigger than others, but they're all circles. Everything's a circle. Remember that Harry Chapin song, All My Life's a Circle? I love that song.
Yes, it is. And yet, I don't know if it's a circle as much as it is a squiggly line, you know? there are always going to be ups and downs in our life. And if we just accept that, I think we will be so much happier. We are not in heaven. We are on earth. I think some people are just seeking their happy ever after. And if you ask them, what does happiness look like to you? A lot of people can't even answer that. They just want it, but they don't know the hows or the whys of it or what it even looks like. And I think when we accept that life is a roller coaster, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. And, you know, as Longfellow said, into every life, a little rain must fall. So there's going to be good times. There's going to be bad times. You're going to have moments of bliss and you're going to have dark nights of the soul. But every time you come back from a dark night of the soul in that fermentation process, you come back stronger and wiser than the last time you had that fermentation process. And I think holding on to that is important and recognizing what stage in this up and down cycle of your life you're in can help you learn to hang on and deal with it a little bit longer until you get to that last stage of radiation where you're just radiating joy. But know that there might be a time when you go right back to step one, calcification, right?
Oh, I think that time comes. That's what I mean by circling.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed this book. I know you didn't like it as much, Deb.
But that's okay. I learned a lot. I've enjoyed talking to you about it. And I hope that it has certainly been helpful to our listeners. I think it's always great to look at varying perspectives on a given topic. And I hope they have.
Yeah, I hope that you have too. I enjoyed it. I like any book that makes me think differently, that challenges the way I normally see things. So I really enjoyed it. I hope some of you listeners did as well. Let's talk about our February choice. Deb, tell everyone what you picked.
I love this book. You've heard us talk about it a zillion times. Now you're going to get an opportunity to read it with us, and we're going to talk about it a lot more. And the name of the book, it's an old book. It's a wonderful book, but it's still in print and still available. The name of the book is Testimony of Light by Helen Greaves. And that's spelled Greaves. Helen Greaves, Testimony of Light, one of my all-time favorite books in the whole world. And I know it is. Samantha loves it too. And we're so excited to share with you the ideas that Helen presents as she brings us information from her friend, Sister Catherine. And we dive deeply into a look at what might be life on the other side.
Yes. And so when Deb suggested this book, I was like, well, we can't do that because it's out of print and copies are going for like $50. So I go online to check and it's back in print. So you can get it from your local bookstore if you ask them to order it or any online bookseller. So I'm so happy this book is back in print. And I'd like to think that you and I talking about it so much might have contributed to that, but I doubt that was it.
Here's a question I know we're going to get asked. Is there an audio version of it?
No, it's only Kindle or paperback. And so it's about Helen Greaves has a friend, Frances Banks, who died. She had been a nun for 25 years in her life, and she was the author of her own books. When she dies, Helen Greaves starts receiving communications from her about what life is like on the other side and what she's doing over there. And we just found it absolutely fascinating. And so we look forward to diving into this and sharing our thoughts and, of course, what Helen Greaves revealed with you guys for our February book club. So we really hope you read along with us. Thank you guys, as always, for tuning in and listening to us. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or subscribe to our show and leave us a positive review. We'd really appreciate that. Don't forget, you can check out Deb's work at debbowen.com, and you can check out my work at samanthafay.com. We hope you have a great week. Please remember, as always, to be the light for yourself and others.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Psychic Teachers, your podcast for seekers, lightworkers, mystics, and magical thinkers. If you like the show, please tell a friend or leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast. For more information, check out our Facebook page, Psychic Teachers, or our websites, samanthafay.com and debbowen.com. I have a new book out called The Awake Dreamer, Lucid Dreaming, Astral Travel, and Mastering the Dreamscape. You can find it wherever books are sold. Thanks for listening and have a great week.